Hi, this is Nathan from the ISPOR Professional Society for Health Economics and Outcomes Research, University of Calgary Student Chapter, in collaboration with the University of Alberta. Today we have a special podcast on the topic of adopting a universal pharmacare program for Canadians. And we have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Mike Paulton, Assistant Professor at the School of Public Health at the University of Alberta. As indicated on our webpage, where you can find previous episodes, I want to start by noting that the funding to start this podcast was provided by ISPOR in the form of a student activity grant, but the views and information provided do not reflect the views of ISPOR. Importantly, as at the time of this recording, we are in the midst of a federal election campaign here in Canada, I want to state that today's podcast episode is intended to be nonpartisan, and we encourage all listeners who are eligible to vote to go out and vote on October 21st. Okay, so let's get started. First of all, thank you, Mike, for coming on our show today and offering your expertise on the topic of universal pharmacare.
Thanks very much, Nathan. It's great to be here.
All right, well, just for some background information, which you can also read up on in more detail in the links provided in the blurb for this episode, I want to bring attention to two reports that were recently released. One is the final report of the Advisory Council on the implementation of national pharmacare, and the other is the Steering Committee report on modernization of price review process guidelines from the Patented Medicine Price Review Board. The latter one, as I understand, Mike, you helped to inform as chair of the working group. So the timing of these reports brings us into a federal election with some parties raising points related to these reports on the campaign trail. We won't get into the differences in party platforms here, but if today's topic is of interest to Canadian voters, I encourage you to dig into those platforms to find out how the parties are approaching the recommendations raised in these reports. Okay, well, I'm going to lob you a general two-part question here, Mike.
Okay.
First question is, can you tell us what is a universal pharmacare program? And then the second part, can you tell us what need does it address in our public health care system here in Canada?
Okay, absolutely, Nathan. Thanks again for having me here. So a universal pharmacare system is a system by which the medicines provided to individuals through some public payer. Universal means that it's intended to cover everybody, that we don't exclude anyone from access to the system. And a pharmacare system is one in which it's basically universal public insurance for drugs. Everyone pays into the system, and when anyone needs a drug, it's then paid for out of the system. In a nutshell, that's what a universal pharmacare system is. And as it stands in Canada, there are a number of existing pharmacare programs. None of them are universal, right? We have over 100 government-run drug programs in Canada currently. We also have many, many thousands of private plans, but there are many individuals who then still slip through the gaps. So that is why there's been a lot of interest recently in establishing a universal pharmacare program.
Yes, and in addition, we have people that aren't funded with any plan.
That's right.
So they're paying out of pocket or
That's right.
having unfilled orders and returning to hospital, as I understand it.
That's right. So most Canadians currently have a private plan, and most of those are through their employer. So that's what I have personally. I work for the University of Alberta, and if I need any medicines, they are paid for through a private plan that the University of Alberta pays into on my behalf. There are some individuals who do not get private drug coverage through their employer, and many of those individuals are left having to pay out of pocket. There are also some individuals who are covered under government drug plans, covering the elderly or those on very low incomes, for example.
Okay, so the strength of a universal program would be, one, to allow access to funded drugs for those that currently don't have a plan, but then how would it help people that currently have a plan? Are we seeing some unraveling of the private plans at this point? We certainly look at that when discussing health economics, looking at insurance plans and adverse selection problems. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so let's talk about adverse selection, since you brought it up. So this is one of the first things that health economics students are taught, is adverse selection. And let's take an even bigger step back. Why are we even talking about plans? Why don't we all just pay for drugs out our own pocket, like we do for many, many other goods in the market, right? The reason that health is often considered to be different from most market goods is that there is considerable uncertainty in when and where you will need healthcare, and considerable uncertainty as to the cost of that healthcare. You might have an accident one day and need many, many thousands of dollars of emergency care. So because of those properties, because it's highly uncertain, there's a demand for insurance. Like with many other things, like car insurance and home insurance, there is a demand. People are willing to pay a small amount every month into a pool. And then when anyone from that pool has a catastrophic cost, they can then the pool then pays for that cost, right? That's how insurance works. Now, one of the issues with insurance is whether individuals volunteer to be members of the pool, right? So this brings us on to adverse selection. Imagine you have an insurance plan and people can opt in or out of the pool. And some people in the plan are high risk, so they're more likely to incur high costs. Other people in the plan are low risk. Perhaps these are younger, healthier people who are less likely to impose costs on the plan. So imagine that everyone is charged some average rate. Everyone pays the same amount in. It's just enough to cover all the costs of everyone in the plan. If you're low risk and you know that you're low risk, you have a good idea that the amount you would be paying into this pool is more than what you would pay out of pocket if you didn't have insurance. And if it's optional to be in the plan, then you have a very strong incentive to leave, right? So you would leave the pool. What then happens to the average cost of those left in the pool? It's going to increase very slightly. So the next less risky person in the pool decides to leave, right? They decide it's not good for them. And then the average cost increases even further, which causes someone else to leave the pool. And then eventually, this insurance market just unravels, right? This insurance plan. That's called adverse selection. The way to stop that is to force people to be members of the pool, right? So anyone who's been following the debate around Obamacare in the States, all the discussion about the individual mandate, right, which required people who are quite healthy, who otherwise would not want to pay for insurance, it requires them to be members of the pool. And this is necessary in order to stop the pool from unraveling. So currently in Canada, as I said, most people have private health insurance. Most people get that through their employer. And that provides some barrier from people just leaving the plan, right? If I decided that my plan at the University of Alberta, that the private insurance plan, if I decided that I was at the low end of the risk spectrum, I couldn't just decide not to pay into the plan. Everyone at the university pays into the same plan, right? The problem with using employment as your mechanism to keep people within the pool is it then has impacts on the flexibility of your labor market, right? Some people might choose not to leave a job for an otherwise better job if the insurance benefits are different, for example, right? So a universal pharmacare plan has some advantages in this respect. It's paid for through people's taxes. Everyone has to pay taxes, right? You can't avoid that. And it would cover everybody, regardless of their risk. So there are some, if we go back to fundamental economic principles, there are some real benefits to having a federal, at the national level, plan which people are required to pay into.
Well, that certainly helps me make more sense of this universal pharmacare. Because we do see this other option come up, which is that fill-in-the-gaps approach. But you could certainly see through adverse selection and other, well, from the provider, insurance provider perspective, some issues around that would result in unraveling of those plans.
Okay,
and
so
people in those plans.
So I didn't fully answer your previous question, which you asked what the implications would be for the private plans. And of course, if everyone is covered through a public plan, then there wouldn't be a need for the private plans. And as the Hoskins report, the final report of the Advisory Council on the implementation of National Pharmacare, the first page of the executive summary says that currently we have a patchwork of more than 100 government-run drug insurance programs and more than 100,000 private drug insurance plans. Right, for a country of 35 million people, over 100,000 private drug insurance plans. And this would have an impact on that market, of course, if there was a single large government plan. There's an advantage in terms of the administration overhead. You would expect it to be much lower per person for a single plan. Imagine the overhead of running over 100,000 private drug insurance plans. So there's unquestionably going to be an impact. Now, another way of doing it would be not to have a universal system and instead have a fill-in-the-gap system. So you would keep all of those 100,000 or more private drug plans, as they stand now, and you would attempt to identify where the gaps are, and you would fill in the gaps. It would be less expensive for the federal government to do this. You would have to identify the gaps in over 100,000 private drug plans. So that's not an easy thing to do. But there is a bigger problem, which is what you touched on in your question, which is if employers know that if they don't provide private health insurance, that the government will step in and fill in the gap, there is an incentive to create more gaps. So you would expect the current system to unravel, right? As a private employer, why would you pay into a system if your employees would be covered by the government if you didn't pay into the system, right? You could not pay into the private system and give your employees a pay rise or keep the profits for yourself, right? There is an incentive to do that. So you might expect the current system to unravel if there was a fill in the gaps. Essentially, there'd be more and more gaps until eventually, somewhere down the road, you have something that approaches a universal system. But in the meantime, you've had all the administrative overhead of identifying these gaps and trying to fill them in. Not to mention that you will miss people, right? You won't fill in all the gaps. And so there are the equity implications of that, right? There might be some people that still fall through the gaps.
Well, yeah, it sounds like inevitably we would end up with a universal pharmacare type program if we started with a fill-in-the-gaps approach.
If you committed to filling in all the gaps, yes. And then as more and more gaps appear, which they will, you committed to filling in those, then you would end up with a universal system. If you didn't do that, if you thought you could just do a fill-in-the-gaps and get away with it as a cheaper system, more gaps would be created, you then don't have the funding to fill them, and we're still left with a system with gaps. There'll still be inequities. Right? It'll just be an even more complicated system than we have now. So I think there is some merit from an efficiency point of view, not to mention the equity point of view, in just having a universal system from the start.
Well, that's great. And thanks for those details on the universal pharmacare program, Mike. And I want to pick up on what you touched on with equity, I think later on here. But first, you did mention this Hoskins report. That's the final report on the Advisory Council. And what I see from this report in all the recommendations that show how universal pharmacare program is an option definitely worth considering. But in that, there's this emphasis on the fact that drug costs are already too high for existing generic and patent drugs. And secondly, the price of new drugs has been increasing. So the report suggests that a universal pharmacare program would help to reduce costs through greater bargaining power from a single payer. But I think there is an unanswered question here, which is how do we achieve a better price with a universal program? More specifically, I mean, is there any framework in place that would help us to determine what price we should pay for a new drug? And I say this because I think as much as universal pharmacare program helps through concentrating bargaining power, without a good way of determining how much to pay, I think we run this risk of saying yes to more and more expensive drugs because now all of a sudden there's potentially more money on the table. Can you comment on that?
That's an excellent question. There's a number of different parts to this. So you touch on the bargaining power. That's absolutely true. If you have a single payer at the federal level, they're going to have more bargaining power than if you have smaller payers at the provincial level or if you have private drug plans attempting to negotiate on their own. Some of the larger drug plans would have some negotiating power, but certainly not some of the smaller players and certainly not individuals who are paying out of pocket. So concentrating all the bargaining power in one place, you would expect there to be lower drug prices. And that is touched on in the National Pharmacare report. So it says that by 2027, they would expect an additional cost to fall on the federal government of $15.3 billion a year. However, they would expect the total amount spent on drugs collectively across Canada to be $5 billion per year lower. Right? And that's partly due to that increased bargaining power. Right? So you're paying more in taxes to the system. But if you take a step back from that, overall, as Canadians, we're paying $5 billion less on new medicines. So a lot less is being spent through the private system. More is being sent through taxation. But overall, $5 billion less is being spent. And there are questions then about, well, how would you ensure that everyone is better off by doing that, right? Because if people just pay more tax and don't see any increase in their pay, then they might feel that they're worse off. But if employers are not having to pay into private plans anymore, presumably some of those savings can be passed on to employers, right? It's just this won't happen overnight, right? It's an incredibly complex system. Trying to unravel this messy system is going to take some time, right? But I think that the key number to focus on is to take that big step back and say, overall, as a whole, will Canada be spending more or less on drugs? And the report predicts that we'll be spending $5 billion less. Okay, so that's the bargaining power. Now, you also touched on something else that's important, which is how do we decide which drugs to pay for, right? What will go on this formulary, this national formulary? And there are some principles which have been adopted already by agencies such as the Canadian Agency for Drugs and Technology in Health, CADTH, and some of the provincial governments around what we call pharmacoeconomics, which is where we look at the benefits that drugs provide to patients. And there's all sorts of possible evidence of that. Clinical trials, for example, might show that a drug is effective and provides benefits to patients. But we also look at any additional costs that a medicine would be expected to impose on the drug budget. The reason those costs are important is because every additional dollar spent on a drug is a dollar that could be spent on something else that would benefit other Canadians who are cared for through our public healthcare system. Okay, as it stands, we have waiting lists for all sorts of things in Canada. It varies from province to province, but there are all sorts of routine procedures where there are waiting lists. Every dollar spent on a new medicine is a dollar that could be spent shortening someone else's waiting list and improving their health. So when we spend money on a new medicine, the people that decide whether or not to do this face an incredibly difficult task because they have to weigh up the benefits that patients will receive from these new medicines against the losses that other patients will incur, right? The foregone benefits, if you like. So the federal government could use pharmacoeconomics as a means for determining which medicines should be paid for. And it might be that some medicines are judged to be too expensive and they are not covered. And it's important to emphasize the reason they are too expensive is because the benefits they provide are insufficient compared to the costs that are imposed on the budget and in turn the benefits that are foregone by other patients. Okay, do we want to be adopting medicines which diminish the health of Canadians as a whole? Right, they provide benefits to some Canadians but losses to other Canadians, and as a whole Canadians have worse health outcomes. Are those the sorts of medicines that we want to fund? Right, so those are the principles, and those are the principles that that the PMPRB, which you mentioned in the introduction, have been considering. So in the regulations that were finalised back in August, the Health Canada is giving, as of next year, the PMPRB the ability to consider the value that medicines provide, right, using pharmacoeconomics. Now, the question then is, how much is too much? Right? If we're open to the principle that some medicines are extremely good value and they should be funded, and other medicines provide limited benefits at extremely high costs and should not be funded, where do you draw the line? Right? What is that threshold? And that's a very, very important topic, and it's something which the technical working group that I chaired on behalf of the PMPRB considered in great detail. In principle, you want to think about what are those opportunity costs that are borne by other patients? Right? How much benefit can you do with each dollar that you're going to spend on a new medicine? How much benefit could you do if you spent it elsewhere? in Canada, there hasn't been as much empirical work done as in some other countries. So the country that has done the most empirical work is the UK. The University of York has been leading that work. And what they have found is that given the way we spend money, given the way within Britain right now, the NHS spends its limited resources, approximately every £15,000 that is spent on a new medicine could have been spent somewhere else in the NHS and provided one additional quality-adjusted year of life to some other patient. So this isn't just a year of life, this is a year of life in full quality. Australia, there's been similar work done by universities in Australia, and the estimate was around 28,000 Australian dollars per quality adjusted life year. The UK researchers did some work for the PMPRB where they estimated what that threshold would be in Canada, and they estimated it would be approximately 30,000 Canadian dollars per quality adjusted life year. That was something that the working group that I chaired considered. We considered that research to be uncertain, but we didn't know what direction any bias would be. We didn't know if that would be too high or too low. It's certainly something that we need to do more research on in Canada. But as it stands, that is our best estimate of how much health is foregone by other patients within the public health system when we pay for a new medicine. So you could use that as a threshold. You could do. If you picked a threshold that is higher than that, say 60,000, right? If you doubled it to 60,000, there will be some medicines that cost more than $30,000 per quality, but less than 60,000, and they will be adopted. They'll be accepted. Based on our current best estimate of the opportunity cost, we would expect those medicines to result in more qualities foregone by other patients than again by the patients that receive it, such that net population health as measured using qualities, quality adjusted life years, would be diminished. Okay, so is that something that we're comfortable with as a society? That's not a, I don't mean that to be a leading question, like it's a question for us to debate. Like, are we comfortable with spending prices for new medicines that are sufficiently high that new medicines diminish population health? To be clear, they will improve the health of the people that get them. But we could have used the money elsewhere in the system for a better use in terms of quality-adjusted years of life. There will be some medicines, particularly orphan drugs, which cost hundreds of thousands of dollars per quality. Right? And there's good reasons for that. Right? It costs money to develop these medicines. There's a very small patient population. Often the benefits that they provide are very uncertain. The trials are very small. And so we're not certain about what the benefits are, and the costs per patient are very high. So often those medicines have a cost per quality in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. So what do we do? Do we pay for them? The Hoskins report recommended that those drugs be considered using different processes. And the federal government in the previous budget has committed $500 million per year on an ongoing basis for funding those medicines. Now, again, there's no right or wrong answer here. If your priority is to fund as many new medicines as possible, then this would allow some medicines that would not be considered cost effective to be funded. But remember, every dollar spent on these medicines is a dollar that could be spent on some other patient. So it might be that we are spending so much money on these medicines that we could have provided several years of life to other patients for every year of life of the same quality that receive these medicines. And again, there's no right or wrong answer. These are extremely important questions that we should be debating.
So if I might try to summarize that, I think what you were saying about the recommendation in that Hoskins report is an equity or a judgment consideration. We can identify certain types of patients where the cost of those drugs would be higher,
yeah,
but then we treat those patients differently than we do other patients. So that is something we have to be comfortable with too. That's what's implied by taking a different process and that recommendation.
This is an incredibly difficult area. Yes, we need to be very clear. What are these characteristics that are valued more highly than other characteristics? So if you have identical characteristics to some other patient, except that your disease is rare and theirs is common, should additional value be placed on your health? Right? These are incredibly difficult questions. It was something that the working group that I chaired for the PMPRB considered, and we made a recommendation that there is insufficient evidence, both theoretical evidence and empirical evidence, to support putting differential value on improvements to people's health. Right? So the position that Cadeth, which does these pharmacoeconomic analyses now on behalf of the provinces, the position they adopt is that all quality-adjusted life years have the same value. Right? So that's a very clear equity position. It's a contestable one, but it's a clear position that it doesn't matter what your characteristics are. It doesn't matter how old or young you are. It doesn't matter how rare your disease is, how severe it is. If we can provide you with an additional year of life that has the same value as providing another patient with the same, an additional year of life of the same quality, right? That's the same value. It's a normative question. I'm not going to give an opinion on whether we should or we should not. I give high value to some patients. It's a normative question that we need to discuss and that the policymakers need to come to terms with.
And I guess to follow up on that a bit, just thinking from the drug manufacturer side, if you're changing the incentives to where, you know, the money is going to be more plentiful, we might see changes in terms of which sort of drugs come down the pipeline. And we might, due to that, lose out on other potentially valuable drugs because they're not going to be as profitable.
Absolutely.
But then we're also potentially, if we're spending more over here for more expensive drugs, we could see that, you know, our consumer surplus is diminishing and we're actually giving more surplus to the producers in that scenario.
That's right. So it's something which the way I like to think about this in economics terms is any of the listeners who've ever taken a microeconomics class will know about demand curves and supply curves and consumer and producer surplus. Deadweight loss, all of those things.
Fun stuff.
All those things that give nightmares to microeconomics students. Okay, but it's very important, right? So in this context, in order for a drug to be developed and to be launched, there has to be a positive producer surplus, right? So when you lower the price of medicines, if you lower it too far to the point where they're simply not profitable, you wouldn't expect it to be launched, right? Now, the flip side is that if you raise the price too much, then we've talked already about the opportunity cost. It might well be that the net health benefit that comes from your medicine is negative. Sure, it provides benefit to the patients that receive it, but if the price is sufficiently high, then the losses incurred by other patients are sufficiently high that the net benefit is negative. And if we think of consumer surplus in terms of population health, then you would have a negative consumer surplus if you had a very high price. So if you were to adopt a position, and this is normative, right? What if you were to adopt a position that a fair price for a medicine is one in which the price is high enough for it to be profitable, but low enough that it improves the health of Canadians as a whole, then we have to ensure that the producer and consumer surplus are both positive, right? Now, plotting that supply curve, which is necessary for estimating the producer surplus, is quite difficult. We don't know what the marginal costs are that are faced by manufacturers when they launch drugs. That's secret, right? We don't know what that is. We can try and estimate it, but manufacturers don't volunteer that information. We could look at the top end of this range, right? So what is the absolute highest price that's consistent with those principles that I just underlined? You know, what is the price at which the net population health benefit is only just positive, right? And it becomes zero when we price above that threshold that we talked about earlier. So as I said, the best evidence we have in Canada, which is uncertain evidence, is that it's around $30,000 per quality. If you price above that, the consumer surplus is negative. If you price below it, then consumer surplus is positive, right? This medicine is actually providing more health benefit than it's being foregone elsewhere. So my hope is that we move forward as a discipline, as health economists, to thinking in more detail about this consumer and producer surplus and what a fair allocation of that surplus is, right? We very often talk about return on investment and how the manufacturer requires a sufficient return on investment to launch the medicine, right? So that producer surplus needs to be sufficiently high for the medicine to be launched. We can also think about return on investment from the point of view of the public healthcare system, right? Every time a public health system adopts a new medicine, they are investing, right? They are spending money on a medicine. That money could have been used to improve other people's health, but they're spending it on this medicine. So they're making an investment in terms of population health in the hope that we get more health out of this than we lost, right? So you can think of return on investment from the point of view of the public healthcare system. And we ought to require a positive return on investment for the public healthcare system, right? There should be a positive return for the manufacturer and a positive return for the healthcare system. And that requires pricing in that range, where the top of that range is given by this cost effectiveness threshold.
Great. Thanks, Mike. And I guess just to say that there are other complexities here too. Right now we're talking about drugs that are candidates to be launched, but then you also have those generics. So there's a certain lifespan for a patent, but then it can switch over to generic. And so you have to factor in that sort of longer time horizon than just the patent period.
Yeah.
And the price that you would get for the generic.
So two things there. So actually, I didn't fully respond to your previous question on incentives for development, right? So if you think in terms of this consumer and producer surplus, right? If you set a price based on pharmacoeconomic criteria, what are the incentives for development, right? So if you were to say that we estimate that every $30,000 per quali spent on a new medicine loses us a quali elsewhere, right? So that is our limit for how much we're willing to pay. That would incentivize the development of medicines which provide a relatively large benefit in terms of qualis at a relatively low cost, right? There's an advantage insofar as you've been clear about what it is that you value, what you're willing to pay for. If as a manufacturer, you are extremely efficient in your R&D, you're able to produce exactly what we want at a very low cost, you could make large profits at $30,000 per quali, and you'll be rewarded with those profits. If as a manufacturer, you are less efficient, right? You don't develop products that actually improve population health in terms of quality of life years, you charge a very high price for your medicine. Well, then you won't be rewarded, right? You won't receive any producer surplus. So having a very clear cost per quality threshold actually sends a signal to manufacturers. This is what we want. This is what we value. This is how much we're willing to pay for it. And if you can develop it at a lower cost, then you'll get some profit. And if you can't develop it at that cost, well, then we're not interested and you won't get profit, right? It's a very clear signal. As it stands, we're paying higher and higher prices for new medicines. And there isn't that signal being sent to manufacturers to keep the costs low, to produce as much benefit as possible. And you'll be rewarded for that. That signal is not there. So I think there are benefits. And through the Orphan Drugs Act and other legislation, we have incentivized the development of very, very high cost orphan drugs, which have a very high cost per quality. So it's actually the opposite incentive that's been provided there. Well, you also mentioned, what about the long term, that you'd expect prices to come down over the long term. That's a really interesting question, right? So, and it's something which there's debate within the field of health economics about. Is it reasonable to pay a very high price for a medicine during the patent period on the basis that we would expect the price to fall post-patent, right? So is it reasonable to have a zero or even negative consumer surplus for the length of the patent period if we expect there to be a positive consumer surplus later, right? So there's all sorts of arguments here. You could say, well, by offering a high price up front, that incentivizes the development of the drug. If we didn't do that, the drug wouldn't be developed and we wouldn't get the positive benefit later, right? You could also say that even during the patent period, we ought to have at least positive consumer surplus. And if you look at other markets for things that are patented, that have a monopoly provider, most consumers would expect to receive some surplus during the period that the patent applies. There's also the question of how long medicines are actually used post-patent. Very often now medicines go off patent and they're very quickly replaced by another patented medicine. So if we're going to base this argument we should have a high price in the short term because we get a lower price post-patent, how long are we actually enjoying that lower price post-patent? Right, so it's incredibly complex. But I mean, for now, the position that the PMPRB adopted is that it is responsible for ensuring there is a non-excessive price during the monopoly period. So it did not look at the potential for a lower price later. Its focus is only on the patent period. But it's a fascinating area of research.
Well, thanks again, Mike. And I think I'll try to circle back to this universal pharmacare. So from the points that you've raised and elaborated on, I think we could say right now that there are gaps in Canadians' access to important drugs and that universal pharmacare is a strong option for drug reform, which has the potential to provide benefits to many Canadians. But to maximize these benefits, we also need to figure out how much we ought to be spending on those drugs we seek to fund. And I think this comes down to that opportunity cost. If we fund drugs that are not good value or not aligned with what we consider to be of value, then those drugs will come into cost to someone else who is also seeking and equally deserving of quality health care here in Canada, but is denied or delayed in receiving what they need. And that causes a negative impact on their health. Is that right? Is there anything else you'd like to add?
That's a fair summary. This is an incredibly complex area, as we all know. And there's no simple answers. There's no simple solutions to these problems. But we can look at the theory. We can actually try and learn from it. And I think it's very clear that in this case, having a universal system would alleviate some of the problems with adverse selection. It would result in greater negotiating power in the hands of the federal government that would result in lower prices for drugs across the country. But let's be clear, implementing this is not an overnight task. It's incredibly difficult. There's all sorts of issues related to the federal government and the provincial level, the powers of each, and they have to be coordinated to do this. Like, this is not a simple task at all. Canada is the only country with a universal healthcare system that does not have universal pharmacare. Okay, that's something to bear in mind. So if we think, well, this sounds impossibly complex, how could we ever do it? Well, every other developed country with a universal healthcare system has universal pharmacare. We're the only ones that don't, right? So the question really should be, why haven't we done it already? There'd be some pains in doing it, right? It would take many years to actually implement. But the theory, I think, is pretty clear that this would save money. And as the Hoskins report has said, we would expect there to be billions of dollars in savings per year once this is fully implemented. But it would, as we've talked about, raise questions about where do you draw the line? Even under a universal system, we cannot fund every medicine. So where do you draw that line? And the proposals in the pharmacare report are that there would be a national formulary of medicines that is established by a national drug agency. I would hope that pharmacoeconomics is used in establishing that list just to ensure that we get the most bang for the buck from that list. But there will then be some other medicines that are not covered under that list. Orphan drugs have been identified as a candidate for, you know, quite a lot of orphan drugs will not be on that list. So this report has recommended other processes for dealing with that. Okay, so if as a society we are concerned about this, then this is one potential approach for dealing with it. But I would say, again, the opportunity cost still falls on other patients, right? We can allocate $500 million a year to pay for orphan drugs, but that's $500 million that could provide more years of life of the same quality to other patients if it was spent elsewhere in the system. So it comes back to our values. What is it that we value as a society? Do we want to, is the purpose of the healthcare system simply to improve health? Or do we also want to adopt new technologies, even if doing so diminishes population health? And those are not simple questions. So it's a topic that requires, you know, a lot of debate, and it's fantastic that you've chosen this as a topic for your podcast and that people are engaged and listening. So this is something that requires a lot of serious discussion. I'm really pleased you invited me on. Thank you.
Well, That is all the time we have for today's episode, and we really appreciate your time and for sharing your insight into today's topic, Mike. And thank you to our listeners. If you have any comments or suggestions, please check out our other episodes and feel free to email us with your thoughts. The email is hep.ispor.podcast@gmail. That's hep.ispor.podcast@gmail. Hopefully today's episode gave you something to consider, and we encourage you to check out those links in the blurb. For our Canadian listeners, have a happy Thanksgiving. Maybe keep the politics out of the dinner table conversations, but remember to go vote on October 21st.
Absolutely.
Thanks.